What's up, guys? This is Jacques. Welcome back to Unpopular. Today's show is pretty iconic because I have one of my favorite people ever. It is Dr. Drew. I have been obsessed with him since Celebrity Rehab, and I cannot believe I got him on my podcast, to be honest. So this is definitely a bit of a milestone for me and the show, so let's celebrate that and let's send some good vibes to Heather Dubrow, because without her, this wouldn't have been possible. So all grace and glory to Heather Dubrow right now. Drew and I spoke a lot about Celebrity Rehab, which is honestly one of the best reality shows of all time. If you've never seen it, it was a show where they would get celebrities in treatment for drug addiction and sex addiction, and they would follow them in a facility while they, you know, detoxed and worked through their issues. It really had everything because it did a great job of like balancing salacious drama with more educational moments and real issues, and it was also fun to see what kind of Z-listers they would pluck out of obscurity for this show. I mean, some of the people that came through this program was like incredible. When I actually start doing paywall content at some point, like, I don't know, Patreon or something like that, I'm actually thinking about recapping old episodes of Celebrity Rehab for people that want to hear that, because that's how good it is. But before we get into Dr. Drew, let's just go over a few hot topics. Apparently, it's the Oscars today, which I had no idea about until I went on Twitter to check out the reactions to the Real Housewives of Atlanta reunion. I mean, is there a more antiquated and irrelevant institution than the Oscars anymore? Like, how much longer are they going to pretend that anybody besides the celebrities who attend the show actually care about this thing? I mean, every year I do like to jump on the Daily Mail to see what everybody wore, but that's it. And nobody had a mask, by the way, which confuses me. Like, I'm sure their Hollywood doctors have all vaccinated them on the down low, but they're around like random stylists and publicists and makeup people, so I thought that they would still social distance and wear masks, like even if just for the optics. So I don't know. I honestly cannot keep up with the COVID rules anymore, and I barely leave the house as it is, and Sydney has next to no cases, so I'm good. I just watch from afar with confusion because I just never know what the fuck's going on with this pandemic. Anyway, I did see some cute Oscars dresses on the red carpet. I don't know who any of the celebrities were, but they looked cute. I thought maybe we would get some like lame social justice dress code this year because of everything going on. Kind of like when Harvey Weinstein got busted and it turned out that everybody in Hollywood was a rapist and all the celebrities showed up wearing like black designer gowns to protest. Like, God forbid they actually stay home and miss out on getting their photo in Us Weekly. They still had to come, but they all wore black. They should have come dressed as geishas this year for Stop Asian Hate. Can you imagine, like, everyone shows up looking like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's? Oh, that would be so funny, and I would not put that past Hollywood. I have no interest in this. I haven't seen any of the movies. You know, the last movie that I watched was, what was it? Reality Bites with Winona Ryder. I watched that on, like, streaming the other week. It's pretty good. It was about Gen Xers in their early 20s, and they're figuring life out during uncertain times, and you realize that nothing has changed, because all the shit that the Gen Xers are dealing with in this movie is the same shit that, like, millennials went through and now Gen Z are dealing with, just worse. So, I mean, it's kind of depressing, right? Anyway, they did air a new Bachelorette trailer during the Oscars, so that was exciting. And you know what? Since my last episode calling out Crazy Colton, there has been a petition with like 35,000 signatures so far to stop Colton's Netflix deal. Kind of makes me happy that I called him out at the start and I didn't just blindly celebrate him coming out. By the way, I got Dr. Drew to diagnose Colton, and it was pretty spot on, I think. And you know what? The other day, I actually posted some of the court documents from, you know, Colton's stalking case on my Instagram stories, and someone responded to me. They said something like, oh, I expected these to be a lot worse. He just seems, you know, really clingy, which is true. It's like he didn't assault anyone. He didn't do anything hardcore. But to me, what's scary about his behavior was the escalation in it, because it went from being clingy to standing out the front of Cassie's house like multiple times a day to putting the tracking device on the car to sending fake text messages. Like, you have to think, where does he go from there if the behavior is escalating in this manner? Like, if Cassie hadn't gone to the police, what could have happened next? Like, he could have turned physical, because to me, that shows quite a dangerous pattern. You also have to think of it from a woman's perspective, honestly. Like, Colton is a whole lot of man. I mean, 6'3", broad shoulders, cute face, he's not afraid to cry. Now, If Colton stalked me, would I enjoy it? I think I would. I think that my dream is to have a man like Colton stalk me and put a tracking device on me. But I'm a man. Cassie's a petite young woman with this mentally unstable former football player showing up to her house at all hours of the day, displaying increasingly disturbing behavior. That's pretty scary. And I don't hate Colton. I just think he needs help and he needs to address this issue. So yeah, I'm not going to give Colton a pass. Sorry. You know, I am surprised, though, that nobody has attacked me yet for calling him crazy all the time. Like, that's mental health shaming. I've been waiting for that, but no one said it. I guarantee in 3 years' time, like, Colton's going to come out on Good Morning America and, you know, he'll come out as suffering from some kind of mental health issue and he'll become an advocate for it. And Bachelor fans will dig up my podcast that I've done and they'll be like, Colton was suffering and we have these hateful bloggers and podcasters shaming his mental health. So bookmark this for when that happens to me in 3 years' time. You know who did just get cancelled for old blog posts? Reality Steve. He's the guy that does all of the Bachelor spoilers. And I'm pretty sure, by the way, that he has apologised for his old blog posts in the past. But, like, people seem to recirculate them every now and then whenever they want to try and take him down. I was going to do a bit of a deep dive on this whole thing, actually. But, you know, I've got Drew on today and this tea is kind of stale now anyway. So I'll just go over it quickly. Basically, what happened is that Steve was having, like, some kind of tit-for-tat over Matt James with, like, this feminist bachelor podcast called Chatty Broads. Chatty Broads, in retaliation, then dropped a whole episode about Steve's old sexist blog posts, and they read them out on the show, like, word for word for about an hour. It's pretty dramatic and lame. I mean, really, you did a whole episode about someone's decade-old blog posts. Then Reality Steve did an Instagram Live to apologize and whatever, take accountability, whatever people do when they get cancelled. And I kind of felt for him in this moment because, like, I was a blogger too in that, like, same Perez Hilton era, and Steve and I wrote, like, you know, I wrote horrible things like Steve did and that I would be totally ashamed of now. So I can, like, relate to him as far as having your past mistakes documented all over the internet and trying to move past it and grow and then having some fucking loser throw it back in your face. Like, you know, you just wrote it yesterday when it's, like, back in the day and it's a different time. Like, people honestly forget what the internet was like during the Perez days. It was like anything goes. We were such assholes back then. But I actually have a no apology rule now, I decided. I decided this the other week. I was like, I am not apologizing for shit. Like, if my horrible old tweets resurface, I'll apologize to the individual. I'll be like, you know what, Christina Aguilera, I'm sorry I called you fat. That was really cruel. It was a gross thing to do. I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed by my actions, which I would be. If a, whatever, fat shaming tweets or something come out, like, I'll feel like a total see you next Tuesday. I'll feel like shit, but I'll apologize to the person individually. Like, I'm not apologizing to random strangers on the internet that I've never met and that don't even know me. So anyway, like, Steve's doing his Instagram Live and whatever, apologizing to everyone. And then Demi drops all these text messages on Twitter exposing him for a few things. Not Demi Lovato. Demi is one of the biggest Bachelor stars. This is Demi from Colton's season, and she's best known for coming out as bisexual on Bachelor in Paradise. And I mean, that's a whole fucking thing in itself. But so Demi attacks Steve first for outing her, which I think was, like, such a reach. Like, girl, you came out as bi on a reality show for publicity. Like, let's not turn this into a whole thing, you know. Demi has even admitted when she was on Colton's season that she would, like, rehearse what she was going to do and, like, plan everything. Like, she's very calculated. Love her. But let's not act like, you know, she was this poor victim that was, you know, like, shamefully outed in front of the world. Like, she went on a publicity tour about being bisexual and it got her so much clout and, like, so much, like, Instagram followers and everything. So good for you, Demi. But Demi also shared how Steve had, like, called her up and told her about this sexual dream he had about her, and it seemed pretty inappropriate. To me, it came off like he would be hitting on her, because why would you, as, like, a man, call up some woman and start telling her that you had a sexual dream about her? Like, even if it's funny, like, you're obviously, like, feeling things out to, like, that's kind of, like, inadvertently making a pass at her, right? And she explained how most of the people on The Bachelor are actually scared of Steve and they don't want him writing badly about them, so they kind of feel pressure to be nice to him, and that by him calling her up and hitting on her, he was abusing his power a bit, which, I mean, I can see that. And I am a Demi fan, so I actually went on my Instagram afterwards and I was making fun of Steve a bit in my Instagram stories. It's like this chubby middle-aged guy is hitting on these hot young bachelor babes. Like, what a creep. And he's always exposing other people in Bachelor, and he fuels a lot of the crazy cancel culture stuff within the Bachelor fandom, you know, that Reddit culture that I bitch about with Bachelor fans. So I didn't really feel that bad for him that it blew up in his face, but you know what? I do kind of feel a little bit sorry for him now because he did a podcast afterwards addressing it all. And I just kind of thought, this poor loser, like, look, I don't know if he was knowingly abusing his position of power to flirt with these bachelor hotties or if he's just delusional, but he said in the podcast that he had to start texting all of his bachelor friends asking if they actually like him or if they're only friends with him for clout. And he sounded sincere. He sounded quite defeated. It's like he just had this revelation that, you know, all of these 25-year-old Instagram models, maybe they don't like his personality. Like, maybe they do just hang out with him because he's very influential within Bachelor. And it's like his whole world was crumbling down right before him. I just thought, oh, poor thing. Like, it's got to be hard being this, like, dumpy middle-aged dude surrounded by these super hot, cool TV stars all the time. They're like the popular kids in school that let the nerd hang around them because he does their homework for them or something. And it's like he's just realized this now. And you know what? I've been there before. Not that I, like, hit on reality stars, but, like, I've forged some really genuine friendships with reality people, but I've also experienced kind of the other side where you feel like you're friends with them genuinely, but then you realize, oh, this is just a transactional relationship and nothing more. And it's kind of like, it's tough when you realize that for the first time, because I remember it happened to me in Australia during one of the seasons of The Bachelor, and I felt like I was, like, you know, helping people and getting to know them. And then I realized it was just a media thing. And I was kind of upset about it. And I'm just like, you know what? I fucking don't give a shit about these people anymore. And I was kind of over it after that. Anyway, do you guys think that, like, Bachelor contestants have been banging Steve on the down low for pressing his blog? I would not be surprised. So let's see if something like that comes out. Maybe there'll be a Bachelor Me Too of, like, maybe we're going to have some people come out and go, you know, I had sex with Steve, but I just felt pressured to. Anyway, one last thing. I won't say who this was because I actually don't want drama, believe it or not, but someone was being super shady to me about my last episode, about the Portia from Housewives of Atlanta, about her Black Lives Matter stuff. They didn't name me directly, but they were obviously talking about my podcast, and they were so condescending, and they said that they framed it like I had come on my podcast and I said that Portia, that she wasn't passionate about Black Lives Matter and that she was faking it and that she didn't believe in the cause, which that is so not what I said. And that really pissed me off because I've done two episodes on this and both times I went out of my way specifically to say that, yes, Portia does care about BLM. Yes, I think her activism is amazing and inspirational and commendable. Like, I never took her activism away from her or said that it wasn't authentic. I said that she also used it for clout and publicity. Like, two things can be true at once. You can be doing something for genuine reasons, but then also take advantage of that situation for, you know, other reasons. And what I've said is no different to what Kenya and Marlo have said about Portia. Actually, they've probably said harsher than what I did, because I did always make sure to make the point that I do believe that Portia's genuine about the cause, which, I mean, who isn't genuine about the BLM cause? You would have to be a fucking sociopath to not care about that. So, and Candy said it too, by the way, the same thing that Kenya and Marlo have. Like, Candy has been more careful with her words because she doesn't really like to get in hot water over things, but it's really obvious that she agrees with Kenya if you look at her comments. And Marlo was just on the Hollywood Unlocked podcast last week, and she said verbatim that Portia was doing the social justice for clout and using it for clout, and she went in. She was savage. So it just pissed me off that someone would, like, go on their social media and act like, I don't believe that Portia cares about BLM when I've specifically said that she does, and all I'm doing is stating something that her other castmates, who are all Black women, have said too. So goodbye with that. But the reason I even bring that up, because I wouldn't have mentioned it, but I actually spoke to Drew about how people now, they do try to see the worst in each other, and they take, you know, people out of context and they put their own spin on things. And Drew and I had a long discussion about that because people do that to Dr. Drew as well a lot. Like, I'm sure that Drew has said things genuinely where he's put his foot in his mouth and he's in the wrong, but I have definitely seen a bunch of instances where there's been a certain like story about him in the media, and then I've gone and I've actually like listened to what he said and I've got the full context. I'm like, that is not what the media put on that. So it just was interesting that it kind of happened to me on a obviously a much, much smaller scale, but I could relate to him regarding that. So anyway, let's get into my interview with Drew. Remember, you can follow me on social media at Unpopular on Instagram and Twitter. You can leave me a review. The links for everything are in the show notes. By the way, big shout out to everybody over the last week or two that left me reviews. I got a bunch of new ones from like Britain and America. So I love you guys. You guys have been really, really good with like rating and reviewing and like everything I ask you. Like, I'm really actually surprised. I feel like you guys are like really engaged. So I love it. And you're all amazing. And everything that you need to support the show and find me on social media is all in the show notes. So just go there. So thank you guys. And please welcome Dr. Drew. Okay, guys, I have one of my favorite people on today. He is honestly a dream guest of mine when I created the podcast. He has been on every TV show imaginable, and he hosts about a million podcasts. Please welcome Dr. Drew.
Such a pleasure to be here. I had no idea. I would have come a lot sooner if I understood that this is so important to you.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry about that. Sorry it took me so long to get here.
You are on the top of my list. I have to thank Heather Dubrow for setting this up because—
Yes, Heather's a dear friend, and we were at dinner with them, and— And it's funny when you mentioned Heather and her husband, Terry. I can't even remember how we became friends with them, but we became fast friends. I know what it was. She was on my HLN program when I used to work for CNN. I had her on, and her husband just came with her, and he and I became friends, and she and I became friends, and that was that.
Yeah, she's so nice. And it's funny because before I interviewed her, like because she's been on The Real Housewives and everything, you would have a certain perception of her that maybe she's like a diva or something.
No.
And she couldn't have been more down to earth. Like she was just responded to the emails herself. She's set this up and she didn't get anything out of it. She just went, oh, you like Dr. Drew? Sure. And it's kind of funny because it did make me think about how people do get misrepresented in the media a lot. And I feel like you're a number one victim of that.
Yeah. I have been a lot, and it's bizarre, and I try to figure it out because I figure I must be participating in it some way, right? I always like to take responsibility for everything that happens to me, so I figure somehow I must be doing this, but all I know for sure, and maybe it's that I don't fight back hard, I don't know, somehow I must be participating, but all I know for sure is I've been thinking a lot lately about a lot of science literature that's out there that shows that when people act out on other people in social media, particularly, the part of the brain associated with identifying the person as a person shuts down, and the part of the brain associated with interacting with objects kicks in. And I've always said that I feel like I'm being treated like a cartoon character, like I'm just a cartoon that you can just do with what you please. It's not fun.
It happens so much online in particular. It's weird because we all get in this online. I mean, we all work online. We're all on social media. But then you actually go out in the real world, like to dinner with someone, and it's completely different and no one behaves like this. But then you come on the internet and it's like vicious. And it's like people-
It's terrible.
They're wired now to look for the worst in each other and to look for that transgression that they can find in someone.
Bizarre. It's bizarre. And I have a new policy, which is particularly when peers of mine, colleagues say terrible things, and even other people that I have at least either want to have a dialogue with or I actually agree with, and there shouldn't be any reason there's an act. I call them up. I send them an email. I find their contact. I call them up, and they are freaking cowards. Not one yet has come to the phone. I can't believe it. Not one. And I'm always, you know, it's like, come, let's be collegial. This is, we're both physicians. Let's talk about it. I don't disagree with you. Let's just have a relationship. Not one comes to the phone. That's the astonishing thing to me. Not one. And I've done this a number of times. And it really speaks volumes about who the people are that are acting out on social media.
Yeah, well, if you speak to someone on the phone, you humanize them.
Yes.
And then it's like you would feel shit. You would feel awful.
Yes, you're on it. I think that's exactly it. Is that having them, if I became a human being to them and not a cartoon character, it would expose them to shame and guilt. And people that do this are particularly shame avoidant. And so, their fantasy again is that I'd be aggressive and angry with them. No. I have no desire for any of that. I literally want to have a collegial relationship. No. And
so what do you think is driving it? Do you think it's a social media thing? There's something about it that feels so puritanical. There's a bullying aspect to it.
Yep. You're on it. You're on it. And I, something, well, you know, who are the people that feel at their liberty to aggress against other people and treat them as objects? That is sort of narcissistic, right? Mm. And narcissists are particularly shame avoidant. So I figure that's got to be some of what's going on there. But I've noticed another really kind of interesting thing that's going on is that in the last probably 6 months, it's become increasingly clear to me. I wrote a book called The Mirror Effect about the narcissistic turn, how much narcissism sort of bled, narcissistic traits and even personality disorders really bled into it.
Sorry to interrupt you. That book, was that when you went on Howard Stern and you were doing the narcissism test?
That's when Robin got the test. Yep. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we have now moved, it's increasingly apparent to me that we've moved off narcissism towards histrionic. And some of the features of the antecedent parenting styles that set up histrionic personality is over-rewarding, sound familiar, inconsistency, over-idealizing, all this stuff that my generation did as parents, thinking we were, you know, didn't want the millennials to go through what we went through, as every parent makes a mistake by compensating for whatever shortfalls they experience in their own childhood.
How do you think Gen Z will be different to the millennials?
So far, it looks like, it's funny, I've been thinking a lot about this lately. And so I've been talking to people and talking to Gen Zs and talking to millennials. And by the way, I fault no one in any of this. Not as though millennials should be, this shouldn't be pejorative. It's just, it's just an observation. And like anything, what we should all be doing is trying to find our way back to reality. And particularly for histrionics, being grounded in reality is extremely important. And it's not that hard for people with histrionic traits either. It's not like a narcissist that can't have feelings. Histrionics become overly emotional, but can be grounded. And so it's really, it's funny. I have lots of millennial friends, and I've seen some of them recently start talking about, hey, we got to get real. I think, yeah, that's going to be the answer here. But the Gen Z, back to Gen Z, they are, for the most part, I'm not sure, but what I'm hearing is keep my head down, care about, build a business myself, do everything myself, screw all y'all. That's sort of their thing. Head down, move forward, you know, don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, I wonder if that's a way that social media has kind of had a positive influence, because all the Gen Zs grew up seeing people become famous on YouTube and then build brands and release products and everything through social media. So maybe it has given them kind of that business mentality.
But not the need to be the center of attention. Quite the opposite. They want to kind of, you know, put their head down and just, keep to themselves and not to worry, you know, not worrying about all the mishigas that's going on around them.
Yeah, and I blame the media. I mean, I kind of blame
for everything.
The media for, like,
for everything.
Yeah,
I'm with really you.
I know, and I work in the media, and I hate it. I feel kind of guilt. I don't know if you read the piece that Glenn Greenwald did, but he was calling it tattletale journalism, which I thought was brilliant, about these young journalists who see themselves as like hall monitors now, and they try to catch you transgressing. And then I guess his theory was that it makes them feel morally superior without them ever actually having to go after real power structures. So
ever having to examine their own moral structures. But I will tell you, I've had multiple interesting experiences lately. With misrepresentation in the news, either in print or in social media, whatever it is. Libelous, slanderous, abject lies. They print that somebody says as though it's true. Just somebody. This guy's got something to say. Print what he says. Mm. And I'm really thinking about suing a newspaper right now because it's out of control. Bizarre lies. In fact, even one woman, somebody in the group that this woman was interviewing said I was anti-immigrant, and I was like, what? You were disgusting. That is disgusting. Disgusting. I'm an immigrant. My family's immigrant. What are you talking about? It was really stunning to me. And then misrepresented my professional credentials. I said, why don't you ask me what my credentials are? Anyway, I can't. But let me tell you the positive. The positive was my son was managing my social media. He was doing my social media. And he watched the genesis of false news and false outrage. Twice he got involved in a spin on social media where it went from what we put out into something totally different, into something still different still, and then reported by the news as this fake news version of where we started. Is really something.
And of course, and they don't really even go for comment because then it kills the story. So yeah. They won't go because they won't
or correct what they've said either.
Yeah,
which I found astonishing. The fact that I'm getting used to it. I'm getting used to being aggressed against. It's a kind of a weird thing.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been a fan of yours. I think I discovered you on Celebrity Rehab. And then ever since then, I follow you on and off because you're always doing something like a podcast or whatever. And I remember at the time with Celebrity Rehab, the media would come after you. And every time anything happened to anyone from Celebrity Rehab, you would get right. the blame. And, yeah. you know, me as someone that was a fan of the show and was listening to your podcast, I'd be like, that's not accurate. Like, if you watch the show, you see how much he cares about the patients. If you look at, was it Rodney King died of a heart attack or something, yes. which wasn't even related?
And I got blamed for that.
Yeah, you got blamed for that. And yeah. it's
and so. Rodney was a dear friend, by the way. I mean, like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, so over the years now, when I do see it's like Dr. Drew's latest controversy, I usually assume it's probably not true. And if I take the time to look into it and I go, okay, and then I'll go and look at the original comments that you've made, I'm like, okay, well, this is not how you represented it in the media.
Yeah, so thank you for doing that work. Because nobody else on the planet, you in a different hemisphere, got to it. Well, I appreciate that.
Well, you know, I've actually stopped watching the news over the last couple of months, and I feel a lot better. Yeah. Because it's so toxic and it's quite addictive because it's sort of like watching a soap opera, you know, and once you get out
of
it.
Well, that's what they're going for.
For sure.
They're not going for news. They're going for entertainment.
Yeah. And I feel like I have to do so much work just to figure out what the truth is, because if I watch one story, I'll go, okay, well, now I've got to go and look at what the other person says. And I've got to go and look at, like, you've got to do so much work yourself because they're only going to give you one very biased perspective. So I'm like, I don't have time for this.
You are so right. And no one does that. They just consume what the echo chamber tells them. I was talking to Adam Carolla today about this very issue because I spoke to a 16-year-old on one of my streaming shows who was doing her own essentially news blog that she was putting together with a bunch of peers. And I was interviewing her. It gave me so much hope. She said, you know, we all know the news is totally unreliable. So we have to go out there and look at the information ourselves. And I thought, oh my God, a 16-year-old knows that. That's a good sign.
I get a lot of my news from, YouTube and everything. And I consider myself very progressive. And it's funny because I think that there's sort of a narrative now that if you like question the mainstream news, that you must be like a QAnon or like a bar, which is not true.
No.
And if you look back in time, it was the people that questioned the mainstream and that questioned authority were like the far left. And
that's right.
That's progressive. Right. Whereas now you get thrown in the QAnon basket if you say, well, I don't think that what Rachel Maddow said was true.
It's uncanny how they have switched roles. I've been mostly independent most of the time. I've been in each party and I've been independent. And now I'm independent and I just see the excesses on both sides. It's just I don't want any part of it. And most of the last, well, particularly when I was advocating for emergency contraceptives and for cervical cancer vaccines, you know, for HPV vaccines and things, the pushback I was getting was from the right aggressively, who wanted to tell you how to live. Now the left tells you how to live and the right wants to leave you alone. It's really weird.
I know, it's strange. Although I don't feel like it's the left. I feel like that is, I feel like that's a bit of a mischaracterization, because the left, like, I listen to the left, but they're like independent. They're, you know, podcasters, YouTubers, whatever, with huge followings.
Send me some good ones because I can't find any good sources. I want to understand what I'm missing. I want it on both sides. I want to understand what's going on all sides.
Well, I don't really, for me, I don't really consider like CNN and MSNBC left. I consider them more kind of like corporate centrists. Whereas I feel like the real left are like, okay, we want universal healthcare, we want knock down student debt. Whereas it's more of the center left, I don't know what to corporate Democrats, whatever I label, they're the ones that are hung up in, I guess, kind of the political correctness.
They're interested in being cool kids.
Yeah.
That's all. Whatever that is.
I know.
Whatever that is, they want to be the cool kids.
I know. Do you feel good about the future with new media? Obviously, because you're an early adopter of everything. Like, you got into podcasts early. You're always sort of like, you're on Clubhouse now all the time.
I wander into things. I that's funny to hear you say that, because I don't think of myself that way at all. Since the beginning, I mean, the reason I got on radio, because one Anthony Fauci was out there telling my generation of physicians that we had to educate people about this disease we were just starting to call AIDS, and that this is 100% fatal disease at the time. And I took that very seriously. And when I had a chance to go on the radio, I did, and kept going back once a week for the next 10 years. I thought I was doing community service. That just was interesting and fun and different. And I thought was having the public health impact I wanted to have. So, you know, when things come along, I just sort of explore them. I don't think, oh, this is the new thing, I got to get involved. It was actually Carolla that got me involved in podcasts. And he took me out and he goes, you need to come in here and we'll do one together. I'm like, all right, that sounds, I got time for that. Let's try that. And there was my wife that started the streaming program, because we were stuck at home with COVID, and she and our webmaster put together a streaming show, and it was interesting. It's all been very interesting. And I'm, you know, deeply grateful for the chance to do things that are different and creative and hopefully have a positive impact. I mean, it's always my goal, is just to use media to do good. That's all.
Yeah, well, I always love these platforms, because I feel like they give the everyday people a chance to have a voice and have a platform, instead of having to go through the old kind of media gatekeepers. Before, the regular person could never have a platform to speak about what they wanted to talk about, because it's like, well, you've got to be educated here, and then you've got to get a job at this newspaper.
Yeah. And more importantly, these are real conversations, long form, get into topics, not just empty shibboleths like you know, so much all you see is the lower third and then 2 seconds of what somebody said and that's it.
Do you think it's inevitable that kind of the old corporate media is just going to completely take over like all the podcasting space and everything, and it's just gonna—
I don't know. I again, you know, you're asking me as though I have some sort of special insight. I'm the opposite of special insight. I sort of go with, you know, I sort of get into the flow of the river. I just sort of step in and it takes me where it takes me.
What's your favorite social media app
right now? I told you it was TikTok. While we were, the mics were heating up, I got stuck in a TikTok hole, and I was not an adopter at all until I was sick with COVID. And when I was sick with COVID, I was so out of it neurologically. It was very strange. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't kind of handle it. And all I could do was sit and scroll through TikTok all day. It's all I could do.
It's so addictive.
And I get into very weird, nerdy, you know, physics TikToks and War of the Roses history and all kinds of stupid shit stuff. That's what I get into. But I do. I'm amazed how much I felt by the end of when I finally recovered. I was so grateful for all the content people had created. I thought, well, I got to create some too for people. So I'm trying to.
Do you feel that pressure all the time? Like, you've always got to be, because you're such a workaholic. I mean, I know that, from your past, that you were a workaholic to the level of, therapy and everything. But even now, you seem like, all the podcasts you do so much.
I feel my goodness. I feel sort of weird and inadequate, like I'm not doing enough a lot of the time. I was thinking late, you said you like Celebrity Rehab. You know, remember Shelly Spray?
Oh, yeah. Blah, obsessed with Shelly.
Okay, Shelly's the best. She'd come on this. She'd happily talk to you.
Amazing.
Yeah. she is a dear friend, and she was always an excellent professional when I worked with her, but she, once we went off on our own way, she became blossomed into this amazing, you know, program, you know, running kind of program director, level of sophistication. And, she and I were talking yesterday, and it was just, I just said, you know, people that don't do clinical work don't understand how hard it is. And if you do lots of clinical work, nothing else feels like work. It's a very weird thing. I don't feel like I'm working when I do. Like this to me, you and me right now, I feel like I'm having a social experience. I'm not working.
Yeah, know? That's a good point. Do you ever, so is there ever any moment that you're just like sitting on the couch doing nothing?
Yes. Just before I called you. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So I want to ask you about Celebrity Rehab because it is one of my favorite shows. I actually rewatched the first season before this for a refresher, and it was
Where'd you find it? Where'd you go?
I had to buy it on iTunes in Australia. So they had it, but they didn't used to have it. You couldn't buy it before, but then I found it now and I'm like,
I don't know what VH1 is holding onto it very tight. I don't know what they plan to do with it. And I would do more because there are certainly people out here that need help. And
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, we're jumping ahead, but yeah, is that something that you would be excited to do?
I'd be wide open to it. Sure. I mean, mostly because we would be reconvening the team. I love that team. And I don't know where we would do it because that facility is actually closed. That was never my facility in the first place. That was belonged to a friend of mine. And, you know, we actually practiced at a hospital down the road. We were actually in an inpatient hospital setting. And that he had this residential facility. And I thought, God, I bet if we brought my staff up there, I could put this whole thing into one of his units, take over the unit, use their licensing and procedure and policies and procedures, and just use my clinical team. And lo and behold, we could do that. And
you must have had
so offers. Yeah, we do something like that again. What's that?
You must have had offers before over the years, right? From like networks or streaming services or anything asking you to bring it back.
The producer has talked about it periodically, but he has talked to VH1 and they own it and they won't let us do anything.
Oh, so it's really about the VH1 naming sort of rights, branding rights.
Or whatever, they own it. I mean, they own the whole thing. And to the point where, you know, the old executive producer hired attorneys to see if there's some middle ground, you know, where we could do something. And essentially, if I work with that team and take care of celebrities that have mental health problems, that's it. They own it.
Ah, that's so frustrating. Yeah, because I feel like you could really get a lot of people on there now too, because now with social media, we're so used to putting everything out there. We're not that private about things. So you probably get a lot of people putting their hands up for it.
Yes. And now I think people understand that opiate use disorder is a fatal illness. Mm. That even in the best of hands, fatality is a common outcome. And so the heat I was getting early on was because people didn't understand how dangerous the illness was, how rare it was to recovery, how high the fatality rates were. And I think finally that sort of awareness has hit people. We had a really interesting experience with everybody that we treated I was talking to a woman that is doing research on change. And apparently this experience is very typical, which I didn't know at the time. Which was, they all started out wanting to be on TV, wanting to get paid, wanting to screw with us. They were not taking it seriously at all. So some of them really just wanted to disrupt what we were doing, you know, whatever it was.
I remember.
And we took it very seriously. We did what we normally do. And we did it like 7-8 seasons we did of, you know, various different versions. And every single one of them turned from wanting to screw with us to going, oh, this is interesting. They're taking this seriously. Oh, my God, I'm deriving benefit from this. Oh, my goodness. I want to be a role model for other people to motivate them to participate in this. I'm getting a lot out of this. Other people should be aware of how important this is. That when that started happening, I was mind blown. I was so grateful because that season you just watched, I was so anxious the whole time. Every day I'd come in there and go, you guys okay? Are you okay? Are the cameras bothering you? Is this working against you? Are you okay with your treatment? Blah, blah, blah. And then finally, Mary Carey, the porn star, looked at me and she goes, Drew, I've done just about everything on camera. I'm okay. And I thought, oh, they understand. Right. They understand what it is to be open and vulnerable in front of a camera.
I think you can. It can be easier to be open in front of a camera than in private. I've noticed with my since I've been podcasting, I've been opening up about more things that I probably wouldn't talk about. You know, there was I had an experience where I almost got cast on a reality show, and during the auditions and on camera stuff, having the cameras there, I felt like I could talk more. They're almost like a security blanket. So you feel
it's
like
interesting.
You can
be it's because you grew up in front of them. You probably grew up in front of them. You got used to it.
It also it creates. I feel like it creates a false. It almost makes it feel like it's artificial and it's not real. Like you almost feel like, well, I'm just performing.
You get to distance from it. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you can talk about it because you can pretend that you're just performing, even though what you're saying is actually
real. Interesting. Well, what I found, the other thing I found was surprising with between the lights and the camera, it created. Intensity. Everything was intense for some reason. I could never figure out why it was because I was just doing the treatment the way I do treatment, but it was like on fire all the time. Very strange.
Yeah, well, watching the first season again, it was really quite groundbreaking, not just for seeing people being treated on camera for the first time, but I noticed that they often broke the fourth wall, which reality shows didn't do then. There was a scene that I watched the other day, and Bridget Nielsen, it was after Daniel Baldwin got caught sending.
And by the way, let me just say, Daniel Baldwin is now a dear friend and a wonderfully recovering person living in Syracuse taking care of his mom.
Okay, that's
I mean,
nice.
You would a different person, like a different person. So that's the miracle of recovery, but go ahead.
Yeah, because in that scene, he got caught texting Mary Carey after dark with he had a phone that he hid, and then the people in the other patients, they had a really strong reaction to it, and Bridget Nielsen turned to the camera, looked at the lens and said, I'm disgusted, I'm this, I'm that, and they showed other things with breaking the fourth wall, and they showed you acknowledging the cameras there, showed, who was it, Rico Rodriguez was saying, I can't talk about this on camera, and they never did that on reality television.
Well, that was one of the interesting things that I was having to deal with because I didn't want them to talk about things they didn't want to talk about on camera because if they didn't want this anything out, I did not want them ashamed or anything. If they were the least bit uncomfortable, I'd say, nope, we'll talk later. So I was constantly going, hey, if you're okay, if you want to talk about it, go ahead. And then sometimes they would obfuscate, and I couldn't tell if they were obfuscating because they're drug addicts or because they were doing it for the obfuscating because they didn't want to talk on camera. That to me was another level of challenge to the whole thing.
How did it go with you? I guess the doctor side, you're taking it really seriously, and then you've got a production crew and you've got producers that want to make a TV show. How do you walk that line?
Interesting. So. This is an interesting part of the story. So immediately, segment producers started pulling cameras into. I'd never been on a reality set before, let alone been a part. I didn't know anything that was going on. I just kept saying, look, just roll cameras in a drug unit. There's always drama. There's always drama in a drug unit. You won't believe the drama. It's just always. And I just said, roll cameras. Just don't worry about it. Well. Of course, they had segment producers that are used to producing reality TV. They started pulling people into rooms and interviewing them and screwing with them. You ever seen the TV show Unreal?
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of stuff started happening. I started hearing, Jessica, do you hear what Mary said about you? And Jessica says you're a bitch. And I was like, my head exploded. I went absolutely out of my mind. I saw this happening. I'm like, what are you doing? First of all, I was like confused. Like, what? What is going on? And then it was like, these are sick people in a hospital. What the F are you doing? And it got to the point where I got so upset. In future seasons, I just said, look, all right, we'll do it again. Here's the conditions. No producers ever speak to the patients under any circumstances, number one. Number two, you don't even make eye contact with me unless you have one of four questions. Doctor, how's the patient doing? Doctor, what's it going to cost? Doctor, how long is it going to take? Doctor, how's the family? You can ask those questions. One more question. I'm walking off this damn set. I'm taking these people to hospital. That's it. You understand me? I got to that point. And to be fair, the producers and stuff were all my friends and things, but I scared the living hell out of them because I had to, because they were used to doing things a certain way. And lo and behold, you see plenty of things happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of amazing, though, because I guess when you look back now at Celebrity Rehab and why the show still holds up and it's very rewatchable is that it's not the lame, fake, produced drama that we get on a lot of shows. Like, this is real stuff.
It was real, real. It was, and for us, it was all very familiar. Now, I will tell you the only thing that, for the first season, we were trying very carefully to leave out any mention of 12-step out of homage to the 11th tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the biggest criticism we got in the first season was, where's the 12-step? You guys don't use the 12-step. Well, we do. Then the next season, from then on, we would just call them assignments or going to a class or mutual aid. We'd have sort of code words. So we weren't saying, you're going to attend a program of Alcoholics Anonymous or something like that.
I was going to ask, do you have any nice memories or any memories of Joni Laura, China? Because yes. I'm a really big fan of hers. I was always really fascinated by her and her journey.
Let me just say, I had my brain. I was going to say one thing that I remember now what it was very quickly, which was that in addition to that criticism about not being enough 12-step, which we did lots of, you don't see much treatment because the treatment is boring. What you see is a lot of dramatic moments in treatment, or you see the craziness amongst them or the craziness on the unit and that kind of thing. So one of the things one of the reasons I'd love to go back and do it now is, you know, it was constructed as a reality show, and reality shows are about relationships and drama and all kinds of stuff. Mm. But now you could put on the internet like our entire group sessions, you know, which were 2 and 3 hour sessions, my sessions with the patients, you could put them up on the internet as sort of bonus for people to go to. If they like the reality show part, they can go see the treatment online, which I think would be great.
People would love that because people watch live streams of Big Brother feeds.
These particular groups we did were fascinating. We had so many dynamic groups, but you can only do so much of that on television. So I love Joni. Joni was a dear woman. I don't know if you saw, there's a couple documentaries coming out on her.
Well, I'm waiting for them to come out. They seem to be getting held up or something.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. You'll see the story in the documentary. You'll see some of the stuff was happening at the end. She spent months in a locked unit in Japan. Are you aware of this?
Yeah. Well, I know that she would always go over to Japan. She was teaching English there. I would try to follow her career over the years as a fan. And sometimes she would just go off the grid and then she would pop up, you know, in Japan or something.
Right. And in Japan, she was literally in a psychiatric locked unit for like 3 months.
Oh, an actual unit. I thought you meant like a house, like just.
No, a psychiatric, not hospital, locked unit, a locked hospital. Because she was found, you know, very psychotic, and then she came back here, and somebody started wanting to do some sort of reality stuff with her, and I was trying desperately to get her to a psychiatrist. I believe she went to this psychiatrist I was telling her to go see, and then somebody gave her opiates and benzodiazepines, which is the deadly combination, and again, as prescribed, you don't have to take much. Look at Prince. I mean, he was taking a lot, but that's what happened to Mike Starr. That's what happened to Jeff Conway. A peer of mine gave them a supply of benzodiazepine and opiates to somebody with lifelong drug addiction. It's just insanity that people did that. But anyway, so then all of a sudden Joni was gone. Now Joni was very difficult to work with. She was a very tender, dear person, but very rigid and very difficult to get to engage in any kind of meaningful whatever. And I had a bunch of encounters with her out in the world where I just sort of run across her. And I would have these thoughts like, God, she is so different in this context. I wonder if she had a multiple personality disorder. And I had the opportunity to talk to her mother recently, and she thought the same thing. Because there was the changes from one thing to the next, from wrestler to tender, you know, sort of little girl to these sort of provocative, she was all kinds of different things in all kinds of different contexts. And the mom was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. She may have had a dissociative disorder of some type.
Yeah, well, I know that she had, I don't know what it was specifically, but I know she had some kind of traumatic childhood event. And I remember it was another wrestler was doing an interview, and they said it. This was back when Joanie was still wrestling with WWE and touring. And one of her family members, I can't remember if it was a sister, if it was a mother, someone tried to visit her. And they said that Joanie basically collapsed into a puddle from tears and everything, and had to be like carried back to her room because she couldn't even face it. So it was obviously something that she was carrying with her through her life, and I guess self-medicating with.
I mean, trauma is an interesting thing, and I talked to her mom at length about whether or not there was anything she could remember, and she was mom was wide open to trying to make sense of things. By the way, she was very sophisticated psychologically, and was trying to figure out what this trauma was. And trauma essentially just shatters the brain's ability to regulate. And so when you can't regulate emotions, you seek ways of dealing with it outside of your body. And that, for some people, that is substances. But to have a dissociative identity disorder, usually that has to be kind of a shattering trauma of some type, and kind of chronic too, oftentimes. And I was unable to unearth anything like that.
Yeah, so I guess it'll just be a mystery, but I can't wait to watch the documentary because she is fascinating, and it was interesting watching her on that first season of Celebrity Rehab because you and Bob Forrest were trying so hard to get through, and she just had a wall up. She wouldn't.
And then would deny stuff that we knew was going on, and it was just really hard. But she was delightful. There was nothing not delightful about her. And I remember it didn't make it on the air, but I did some art therapy with her, and she's a beautiful artist. And that started to have some kind of something. I felt like the ice was melting a little bit. And I did send her, a lot of these people we treated for long afterwards, right? And so I had Joanie seeing a therapist for quite a while afterwards, and he just couldn't get anywhere with her.
It's so sad. So during Celebrity Rehab, I mean, with the producers, because I mean, I know that there was a lot of controversy when I think it was Tom Sizemore and Heidi Fleiss came in, and I don't know if that was a producer stunt, but I feel like when you stopped doing the show, I'm wondering, was that because you kept getting blamed for things, or was it because of production?
No. We stopped doing it because VH1 stopped doing it.
Oh, okay.
Very simple. Now you're talking now about sort of the casting process, and I was not involved in that, except that they would come to me and go, here's the case. Can you treat this person? And I would say, yeah, or no, or there were cases we did not treat that I can't talk to you about that ended up too sick or too whatever for this environment. But Heidi and Tom, I knew Tom. I had treated Tom a couple times before, and Tom was in big trouble, and I just wanted to get him in. I just needed Tom. I didn't care if Heidi was there or not. I expected them both to be adults. They weren't involved. Look, what I said at the time, I'm sure I said at the time, I don't remember saying this, but I will tell you that drug addicts run together in all kinds of ways all the time. Mm-hmm. They know each other in different contexts and different everything. I mean, Bob Forrest... A year after Jeff died, Bob goes, yeah, I remember when Jeff used to 12-step me. I went, what? He was in recovery and he used to 12-step you? He was like, yeah, it was at the Jerry's Deli in the 90s or whatever. And I'm like, oh my God, you guys, the addicts just run in different, they run across each other in different contexts all the time. So I just looked at Heidi and Tom as just that. And expected them both to be adults and focus on their treatment. And they pretty much did that. We had some trouble at Sober House, right? I don't know if you remember that.
I did, yeah. I haven't watched it since it aired, but I watched all of them. But I mean, I remember Sober House seemed to be the most dramatic because they were allowed to run out and leave.
Right, because we lost the structure, and so oof, that was very challenging for me when they do that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard Heidi.
I'm getting exhausted just talking about this. No wonder I found that so tiresome.
I heard that Heidi's she's working with the Tiger King producer or something on a documentary, which.
About her birds?
I don't know if it's about her birds or her life or what it's about. I mean, I hope it's about her life.
So it must be about her life. And I'm sure it's her life with the birds. Her whole life is dedicated to the macaw now. And a lot of these people, once I finished caring for them, I would say became friends. I'm no longer anybody's doctor, but Heidi is one of the people. I always felt a peer connection to her. I don't know if they put it on TV or not, but I just remember vividly at her graduation, I was like, Heidi, go to back, get your post back, go to veterinary school. She's so smart. You're so smart. You're a peer. This is what people like you do. You go get a professional degree. Go do that. And she didn't ever want to do it.
I know. I've wanted to interview her, but I've never reached out because, I mean, she's probably hard to get. And then I also
I can get you that one too.
Oh, really?
I'm sure I can get you that. Sure we can get you that.
Can she talk? Does she only talk about the birds though? I mean, I want to talk about the birds.
She is, I don't know. She is really, I love Heidi. She is really a lovely person. I mean, she can't get out of her own way for herself. I worry about her happiness and her survivability and stuff.
Yeah.
But she is so smart and so lovely. So yeah, I'm sure she'd talk to you.
You had such-
My wife's your contact for that.
Oh, yep. You had such interesting people come through the show, like Bai Ling.
We did.
Bai Ling is so on another planet. I love her.
So you should watch what I did. It's so interesting to me. I'm getting chills thinking about this stuff. I did a reunion with about 12 of them on a streaming show.
I watched it.
Did you see Bai on that?
Yes.
She was extraordinary, right?
I know. Yeah, she seemed like she was in a good space.
She was grounded. She was clear. She talked about how what a moving experience. And I believe her when she said that this was a really important experience for her to be somebody to sit down and take her seriously and listen to her story. And if you remember, she was essentially prostituted as a Chinese soldier. She was prostituted to the authorities there.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable, and so bad that she identified with the perpetrators, and we had to go bye. and she really felt supported and good. And she's another one I've run into a few times over the years, and seems to be so much better.
Yeah, she's such a character. I'm so interested by her, and she's so wise with her.
she's like the wisdom of the Orient, right?
Yeah.
She's the Chinese soothsayer. Yeah, it's amazing. They're all. You know, one thing I will tell you about people you know in the media, people that probably interest you, when you, like, let's just take Bai. When you come upon them, you wonder, is this a smart person? Is this what's going on here? I will tell you that any person that I have, that you can think of that's a prominent public figure, when you go into a room with them and you close the door, the thought occurs to me, oh, this is there's something substantial about her. Interesting and substantial. And in Bai's case, also smart. And so it's like there's something about her that even as frail and as goofy as she was and stuff, there was something substantial about her. And that's starting to come out more now too.
Well, okay, that brings me then, what about Farah Abraham? Because, well, one, have you two patched things up? And two, I got to say, she interests me a lot because I
me too.
Watch her in the media and some of the things that she comes out with, I'm like, who even thought this up? This is like, and I think, is she trolling everyone? She put this like weird Christmas single out. I mean, she's always doing something that's just bizarre and it blows my mind. Some of the things she has a music album out and it's like, it's indie, like indie music people love it. Cause it's like an underground, like electronic album. And it's like, it has all these reviews from like indie music press. It's like this hidden masterpiece. She's so, and I think, is she trolling everyone? Is she in on this? Like,
No, she's not trolling. She is, you know, I mean, this is one of the things I worry about with people like Farah who essentially grew up on TV, right? Mm. And whose livelihood has been about TV. And if they try to make another livelihood, what are they going to do except try to, they're naturally going to keep going down this path where there has been pay dirt before and gratification and all the things that she's learned to glean from it. I have no ill feelings towards Farah at all. She has bizarrely taken aim at me a few times, which I found weird. The last time I met with her was I had to meet her in a different city. I forget why we were doing that. And I told her I will miss her. And it was funny. I don't know if you look at that moment, it made it to television. She softened for about 3 minutes in a way I've not seen her in a long time. I said, it's the truth. I've known her across the arc of this intense experience and all that she'd gone through. And I do miss her. I do miss her. She's not It's not like she's an easy person to be around. And it's not like it's always a pleasure to be around her. She was a pain in the ass a lot of the time. I mean, some of the things she put me through was just sort of astonishing.
I never knew if when the cameras go down, is she like, does she pull back or is she just always like that?
Same. Oh yeah. That's her.
Her mom is on another planet too. If you've seen her mother's YouTube channel, it's something else.
Oh really? What's she doing now?
She's a recording artist now. She does rap music. She dances around in bikinis and sings and talks about her music career. And it's, I'll send you a link.
Is she still married to that infectious disease doctor?
The Santa Claus. I think yes, so. Santa yeah.
Claus. Good. Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Okay. How do you, okay. So when you have an awkward moment with a celebrity, how do you patch things up? Because, you know, I was Googling you for this, right? And I remember Mary Carey did a porno parody of you, Celebrity Porn Hab, with Dr. Screw.
Yeah.
Is that awkward when you run into her after she's done that? Like, do you bring it
no,
up?
No, she apologized. She apologized. And that was sort of more, you know, before she was understanding that she needed to take her sobriety more seriously, right?
Okay.
And that we were pulling for her. And she's been on and off for quite some time and really is, can generally move forward. And she apologized. I tell you what was disturbing was I was on Kimmel. I never didn't know this was out there. And he played it on Kimmel. And I was like, Jesus, Jimmy, I mean, what the hell? I didn't, he thought it was the funniest thing ever. And I was like, it's not funny, but okay.
It's funny to everyone on the outside.
I guess so. I don't know. It's hard when, especially then, you know, we were probably hadn't even started our second season yet. And we were trying to take this very seriously. Yeah. And then to have him do that was sort of,
what do you think of this Colton Underwood stuff? Because I don't know if you watched
Tell
it.
Tell me what's.
Well, okay, so Colton Underwood, he was on The Bachelor. He was a virgin. He went on The Bachelor. He had some, when he got rejected, there was a famous scene where he ran off into the woods in Portugal. Like, he jumped over a fence because he got rejected by a woman and they couldn't find him. Then he ended up with
her. Is this a recent Bachelor?
This was, about his season was maybe 2 years ago. I thought you would have known about this. So
I have zero. I don't watch this stuff. One of the signs of how awful the epidemic has been is that I've been deeply down the rabbit hole of 90 Day Fiancé.
I literally had that on my list of questions because I know you're a 90 Day Fiancé fan. I've tried to get on that show and my fiancés keep pulling out. I'm like, hey, I'm going to fly you to Australia. You can be so with me. Funny. They're like, nah.
Oh my God, that's funny. But every week we're like, all I had to look forward to was Sunday night for 90 Day Fiancé. What are Michael and Angela up to?
Do you watch all of them? Because it's about 20.
We watch all of them. We watch everything. And I got to know Angela. She actually was, I did a podcast with her.
Oh, really?
And she's lovely. And she and my wife now communicate quite regularly.
That's hilarious. Is she your favorite 90 Day Fiancé person?
I always think somebody's my favorite, and then they go into a new season with new couples. I'm like, oh, now I laugh out loud at the Russian women that are on this season. I'm like, they are Julia and what's her name? The blonde girl. They just say the funniest things. I just laugh out loud.
Well, so. I enjoy Paul and Carini. I like watching them because it's so.
Which one is that?
No, they were on before the 90 days. He's the guy with he's got the mother, not Colton. And he went over to.
Not Colty?
No, not Colty. I was going to ask you about Colton from Bachelor, but I guess you're not across it. But yeah, he ran off into the woods. He seemed to have some issues on the show. He ends up with this girl, Cassie. Then they break up and then it comes out that he had started stalking her. He was sending, her text messages pretending to be, you know, other people. He put a tracking device on her car.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, all of that came out. And if you
this is the one he picked, or the one?
Yeah,
he
got rejected by her, ran into the woods, but then he came back and he convinced her and he love bombed her a bit. And then and then when it didn't work out in the real world, he started stalking her. And I read the court things, and it was definitely behavior that escalated. It went from clingy to standing out front of her house to putting a tracking device on the car.
How old would you say he is?
I think he's 28 now, 29.
There is a lot of stalking behavior in mid-20s, particularly in that era, because there had been so little. You know, I used to, when I was still doing Loveline, I would hear this all the time where a guy would say, because they're not dating, there wasn't the sort of usual sort of developmental milestones and courtship.
And he was a virgin, say, remember.
Right. And they're often virgins. And the guy, 23-year-old, 24-year-old would call me and say, well, I found the girl. I found the one. I found her. And he says, but she wasn't so interested. So we became friends. And I washed her car every Sunday. And I moved her furniture, you know. And we were friends. And it's been 2 years. And now it's time. And we're like, time for what? Well, she needs to step up now. Now she needs to be my girlfriend. That those 2 years of friendship, straight up simple stalking. And so a lot of stalking behavior that goes by as sort of being a friend or just being in love. It's all nonsense. It's mixed confusing intensity for intimacy. And there has been a lot of that recently. Men, not women. Men.
Yeah. Well, after the stalking thing came out, because that kind of ruined his career a bit, obviously he went into hiding and then he came out the other week on Good Morning America and he came out as gay. And yeah, so that's just there's a whole lot of issues there. Now there's a back and forth because, as usual with the media, then they kind of were like, you know, yay, let's celebrate Colton coming out. And it's like, well, hang on, he did stalk a woman. Like, we don't want to forget that part of it. You could don't just get a clean slate now. So
no, he therapy.
That's what I've been saying, get him on TV and go to therapy.
Yeah. So just two major themes here, which is an inconsistent identity, like an unstable identity, which is a really serious problem in his age group, unclear sexual orientation, and love addiction, stalking, whatever you want to call that, however you want to look at that. Those are three major, major red flags.
Yeah. Well, we've got a cast member for the Celebrity Rehab reboot, I think, Colton Underwood. There's a spot for you there for love addiction.
Or the sex addiction. If we did the sex addiction show again. Did you see that show?
Yeah, I watched
that was really interesting. That was very interesting.
That one was dark too because obviously when people have sex, it can come from all different kinds of things. So the stuff that people get into and the traumas, trauma.
But I will tell you, some of the greatest successes came out of that group, like Jenny Ketchum, Penny Flame. She's now a medical social worker in Washington, married with a child. Absolute complete turnaround.
I heard her on one of your shows now. It was kind of interesting. And she's very, very, very like feminist, very social justice.
Yep.
And it reminded me as well with Amber. I know that she has gone super Christian. Does it ever happen where they maybe they become sober, they lose the addiction, whatever it is, and then they move very strongly into another identity?
Let's just look at the Amber, for instance. Amber really struggled for decades, right? I mean, she had not just bad opiate addiction, opiate use disorder, but she had all kinds of identity stuff and anxiety, all kinds of things. So it kind of makes sense to me when people find when they've struggled so long and they find an avenue that they can build on that's gratifying to them, they go full on.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. Right? Yeah. If it's, you know what I mean? If that's what makes her happy and that's the direction she goes and it's working for her, good.
Yep. So just whatever
it was not working the other way.
Yeah.
And usually they of course, you know, with time things moderate usually. Yep.
One last question I had for you, which this has always interested me just as a fan of you. So Susan had her calling out podcast about the afterlife and psychic and stuff. And that always surprised me so much because you think, like, you medical doctor, that you – do you know what I mean? Like, do you believe in the paranormal? Like, how does that work?
You know, we were on – I'll tell you how it works. So Susan, of course, my wife, and – and you know, we're going into our 30th wedding anniversary coming up a couple months, and she's been a great partner. It's been a great marriage, but we're not the same person by any stretch of the imagination. And she is her thing, and I'm mine, and that's great. And I'm happy to let that be. We did Tyler Henry's show, right? In fact, Joni came up on she made an appearance through Tyler Henry.
Wow!
If you watch,
I need to watch.
He said he was incredible. Well, I'll tell you watching him and why I think that's interesting. But he goes, all of a sudden he goes, there's a big woman here and she's holding a belt and she died of drug addiction. And she told me, she says wasn't willing to listen to what you were saying and you were right. But she keeps, you know, she's big. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, whoa, wee. In that show, the producers do a little post, you know, a little interview afterwards, and they go, you know, what do you think of that? And what's happening here? And I'll go, look, it's interesting. Look, watch. I'll tell you more about what I find interesting. And it's interesting to see him do this thing. But the only thing I know for sure is he's not talking to dead people. At which point Susan goes, he's talking to dead people. So we agree to categorically disagree. I just keep saying, look, they're doing something. I know that because I've watched she and her friends carefully, and there's something happening with these people that do this thing. They're not talking to dead people. And then whenever I would say that, she goes, yeah, they're talking to dead people. Okay, whatever. But what I found, so I have had some extraordinary experiences in therapeutic sessions with patients where uncanny things happen to me. Patients communicate uncanny things to us as the caretaker in a deep connected relationship we call therapy. And I probably, as a patient, probably experienced a little bit of that too. You know, my therapist knew things or was feeding back things to me. It was sort of an uncanny, ineffable quality. But I will hear music and I'll feel pain and I'll have smells and things that aren't things I've ever experienced before. And I will bring up to the patient, I go, you know, I'm hearing this music. I wonder if this has meaning to you. Always. It's always. And almost like, you know, startling to the patient because it's bringing something into the room that is pushed away from their consciousness. So I'm aware that we have a way of communicating with one another as human beings non-verbally, right? There's a lot of stuff going back and forth. It's probably through the autonomic nervous system. It's probably bodily-based experiences. So it makes sense to me that the people that are doing their whatever they're doing, that they're picking that up. They're all very intuitive, and they all will say that. And they're picking something up that's being communicated to them from the patient, from the other person. And I go so far as to say, this is my radical position, is that I really think consciousness is a shared experience. I don't think you have consciousness without other people. I think that's how it gives us that out-of-self experience that we can look at ourselves and call ourselves conscious. And as such, it makes sense to me that the self and the conscious self is constructed of parts of other people that are important in our life. And those parts may be there for other people that are super intuitive to sort of pick up on. Does that make sense?
No, that's interesting. Yeah.
And by the way, so let me just say, when I watched them, like Tyler Henry, I actually wired him up and did a whole special on wiring him up and looking at his EEG. His EEG was unbelievable. It looked like he was hyper alert and asleep. It was the neuroscientist said he'd never seen an EEG like that before. When he does this thing with his hand, you know, he goes back and forth with his hand, which is called a releasing sign. It's a frontal releasing sign. It's a way of shutting down your frontal lobes. And he would sweat so much when he does this. He soaked through one of our chairs. There's still an outline of Tyler Henry on the chair he was sitting in downstairs. And some of my wife's other participants, the women that she works with, they have very strange eye movements that are sort of not at all something you'd normally see you've ever seen anybody do, frankly. And they just have a way of whatever it is they're doing, they're attuning to something, and it's fascinating to me. Yeah. So they're not talking to dead people.
They're doing something, but they're not talking.
They're
to
doing
dead
something people. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, that's interesting because I'm kind of skeptical.
And so I took it seriously. Yeah,
I don't believe in that stuff. But then when you explain it in that way, it's like, well, obviously there's something going on.
There's something going on, and no one has really looked at it seriously, like looked carefully at what is going on here. And I think it can be parsed out. I think it can be figured out.
Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so much fun. Like I said, you were a dream guest.
I hope I didn't disappoint. No. There's nowhere for me to go but down. From dream guest to just that guy that's not a...
No, you know. It was great. Tell people where they can get your podcast. I know you've got the Dr. Drew After Dark. Is that the most popular one at the moment?
Yeah, it is. That's that you're with your mom's house with Tom Segura. It's mostly with his wife, Christina P., though some of them I've been doing alone lately. It's sort of a, it's in many ways, it's kind of a reincarnation of Loveline because a lot of the, those questions and stuff are coming up again.
I can't listen to that one. I find it so, like, the medical stuff grosses me out, but I recommend everyone else because I know people love that stuff. For me, it grosses me out. My favorite was the This Life with Bob Forrest, but you don't do that one anymore.
We don't do that one anymore, but we've been thinking lately we need to bring Bob back on. We'll bring him on the streaming show a bit.
Yep.
So we do a streaming show. It's all at drdrew.com. You can get it right there at the top of the page. So
yeah, great. Everyone go check out Dr. Drew's podcast for sure. They're amazing. And yeah, again, thank you so much. This was awesome.
You bet. I listen, let me just say too, I mean, I don't think I said this on the microphone, is that Sydney is one of my favorite cities I've ever visited. It really is. I know you don't like it that much.
Yeah, I don't know.
I really enjoy it. And my son worked at the Opera House for a month and had a really great experience there. We just had nothing but great experience with Australians.
Yeah, you'll have to come back after COVID for a 100%. Trip.
I would love to do that. So
I know. Get some work opportunities here. I'm sure they'll
come
book
visit.
You, for
you can set it up for me, and that will be the visit. Yeah. We'll do it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Drew.
All right, my friend. Good to talk to you.
All right, that's it for this week, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I enjoyed recording it. You know the drill by now, so if you want to know where to follow me, how to support the show, how to review the show, everything is in the show notes, in the episode description. If there's one thing I can ask you to do, it would be just to share the podcast with your friends and anyone that you know. If there's anyone that you think would be into my little pod, please like spread the word. That will help me grow a lot. And yeah, I will be back a week from now. I'm 90 something percent sure that I have another really good interview guest, someone that I know that you're going to love in particular. Because I haven't recorded it yet, I'm just nervous, but I've got to get up at 6 a.m. to record this damn thing. So they better not pull out after they make me get up that early. Look forward to that a week from now. And again, thank you so much for listening. Everything's in the show notes, and take care.